Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to tonight's edition of Jump Right In, a production of 1111 Broadcasting. This is Splash, and my pond is open. Oh, what a weekend. What a weekend it was. I'm just slid into the host chair, and I'll tell you what, I am so hungry. You might hear my stomach growl. We have got a pork loin in the oven, and the aroma of that thing is just wafting through the house and right into my nostrils. So I'm very hungry. You might hear my stomach growl, but we got a great show planned for you tonight. Had a great show last week, and we're going to expound upon that. I know we're going to be talking a little bit about Mitt Romney tonight and his decision to leave the race. I'm going to tell you this, if there's anything that happened in the news today that impacts anything I talk about tonight, I didn't hear it. That's how busy I was today. Obama is suggesting that we spend a whole lot more money, and we'll talk about that, as well as the Smurfs are again going to go, I guess, with the same message that the Koch brothers are trying to purchase democracy here in America. I don't know what that means, that the environmentalists and Tom Steyer and George Soros and all those other people on the left-hand side of the aisle are trying to purchase, but we'll talk about that. And, of course, the Keystone Pipeline, we know, passed the Senate in bipartisan fashion. That's going to be fun to talk about, but we'll talk primarily tonight about spending, spending, spending. That's going to be a recurring theme on tonight's show. I do want to let you know that, of course, here we go. The number to call if you want to join into the show, 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. Jump right in. Weigh carefully if you must. But remember, everyone swims in my pond at their own risk. We'll be here for the next hour doing the thing I love to do most, talking smack about politics. And tonight, of course, we'll focus on spending. So if you want to call in and tell me what you think about that topic, I'm sure it will be a lot of fun to talk to you. We now have a blog, so all our shows are posted there, past, present, and future. So go to 1111broadcasting.com. You can listen to a show, make a comment and suggestion, or just say hi. You can also follow me on Facebook at 1111broadcasting. Facebook is new to me, so stop by there, say hi, make suggestions on what I might do and what I might do better. If you miss a show, don't sweat it. The shows are links are on the blog and Facebook page. So just go to 1111broadcasting.com or 1111broadcasting. That's the show page on Facebook. Now, you can jump right into the show chat room tonight. I haven't actually launched that, but I'm launching it now. You'll need to get a sign-in from Blog Talk Radio. It takes less than a minute. Put in your address, put in your email address, pick a screen name, a password, and voila, you can jump right into the chat room, pick on people, or even pick on me. I don't always get a chance to pay attention to that, but I love to read that stuff later. Of course, if you want to participate in tonight's show, put your stamp on tonight's episode, wade into my pond, then by all means, dial the number right there at the top of the show page. 215-383-5730. That's 215-383-5730. And I would love to talk to you. Before we get into tonight's show, let me tell you about Choice Mattress and Furniture. When it comes to mattresses and bedding, David Ritter and the staff at Choice Mattress and Furniture know their stuff. Took my whole family to Choice Mattress, and everything was considered, from our weight to our age to even the way each of us sleeps. The right mattress was personally selected for each one of us. Now my whole family sleeps in great comfort all night long on beds from Choice Mattress, and yours can too. Every mattress carried by Mattress Choice comes with a 5, 10, or even a 15-year, 100% full replacement warranty, not a prorated limited warranty like those other stores do. Chances are, if you bought a bed in Daytona Beach area in the last 20 years, then you bought it from David With over 20 years of experience, David knows beds, and you should see all the other fine lines of furniture Choice Mattress has for every room in your home. So go see the folks at Choice Mattress and Furniture, located on the corner of LPGA and Nova Road, 1501 North Nova Road in Holly Hill. If you just have questions, give them a call, 386-226-BEDS. That's 386-226-2337. Choice Mattress, simply the best choice that you can make in your sleep. You know, I'm going to talk about Mitt Romney first tonight because, I don't know, I was just a little bit, the way I heard this go down just really kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And I know a lot of people like Mitt Romney. I met Mitt Romney one time, was on a plane to Vegas. I had gotten the opportunity to bump up to first class. You know, they offer you to do that for 50 or 100 bucks or whatever. And we were on our way out there, and this was actually the connector flight from Dallas-Fort Worth to Vegas. If you ever need to choose a connector flight, I never recommend Dallas-Fort Worth anymore. What a mess of an airport. Anyway, so we're on the plane, and we're taxiing, seems like for, well, it was for almost a couple hours. There was apparently storms all around us, and one runway taken off west that was available. That was it for every plane leaving the airport. So we taxied around for a couple hours. Next thing you know, you're looking out the window and everything looks familiar. We're pulling right back up to the gate. It was crazy. But anyway, in the meantime, while we were taxiing for those 2 hours, I look across the aisle and there's Mitt Romney with apparently an assistant, and they're working on some stuff. He's reading a USA Today. And he finished that up, folded it, put it in the seat in front of him. So I leaned across the aisle and I said, "Hey, are you finished with that?" He pulled it out, gave it to me and said, "Now here, you can have it." I said, "Oh, great, thanks." Anyway, we taxi back, we pull up. There we are. We're asking the stewardess, "What in the world is going on?" And she says, "Well, the new FAA laws under Obama." Now, mind you, this was back in 2000 and I'm going to say it was before Mitt Romney announced that he was going to be running for president in 2012. So it was right around 2010, 2011, something like that. Anyway, the lady said new FAA rules under the Obama administration, if we taxi more than 2 hours, then we have to come back to the gate and allow everyone the chance to get off the plane. No kidding. I'm not telling you a lie. I don't know if she was right. I'm just telling you this is what the lady said. To get off the plane and stretch. You can't make this stuff up. So nobody got off the plane. Everybody wanted to get on our way to Vegas. So we're sitting there. And now the air conditioner is not working right, and everybody's starting to sweat. This one guy made a comment. I don't even remember what it was, but the lady got a little bit pushy with him because it was almost like, you know, it was at that time where you got to watch out for anybody that might cause a problem on a flight. So anyway, we're waiting. One of the things, of course, they do when you do this is they refuel the plane, thank goodness, because you did burn a lot of fuel taxiing for 2 hours. But I lean over the aisle to Mitt Romney, who was not saying anything, and I said to him, this is my only connection, by the way, ever with a famous person, and I said, "Why don't you fix this like you did the Olympics?" And he just smiled and said, "I didn't think anyone recognized me," and of course, he's completely recognizable, but anyway, so he got up, he was talking to the lady, and he found out that now, even though the plane had been refueled, what we were waiting for now, and I kid you not, was an order of granola bars from catering. Now, mind you, not 2 hours ago, we were ready to take off without these granola bars. The whole plane moaned. I moaned. Mitt Romney moaned. And he sat back down and just shook his head. So anyway, the granola bars finally get there. We're finally taxiing. Everybody's yay, right? We get up in the air after another half hour of taxiing, and they go around with these granola bars, and not a soul took a granola bar. You want to talk about a unified protest. That was it. So anyway, that was I did meet Mitt Romney on that flight. And as we got off the flight, I said to him, "You know, you gave me this. You were nice enough to give me this USA Today, and so kind." And I was going to meet a friend of mine, by the way, who was completely not, well, liberal. We'll just leave it at that. Not a fan of the Elmos. And I said, "Would you mind? She's a big fan of yours. Could you autograph this for me so I could give it to her?" And so he autographed it. Of course, I offered it. It was not taken. I kept it because I thought, you know, if he becomes president one day, you know, it'll be worth twice the face value of a dollar that was, you know, it was for sale for. So anyway, but first, let me give you the quote that wasn't in the political article wrote that I read and that I have here in front of me from the Washington Post, where I find it, because this I find amazing. If you want to forego another presidential bid because you already did it twice, or you prefer to focus on your family, or it's too taxing on whatever, that's fine. But listen to this quote. Mitt Romney said, "I am convinced that we could win the nomination, but fully realize it would have been a difficult test and a hard fight." Now, what he's saying here is that the rest of the Elmo field was so weak that I would have won, no doubt. I'm just not up for the grueling fight that I know this wide field brings, especially for a front runner. Been there, done that. First of all, I am pretty sure that this won't amount to much, but what a kick in the head to your fellow Elmos. He's not going to run, he's not going to run, he's not going to run, he's not going to run. Takes a look at the field and goes, you know, maybe I'll give it a shot. Of course, by then, Jeb Bush is also announcing that he's going to be coming in. You're basically saying, the rest of you guys suck. Secondly, I am so glad that Romney did not become president, because not because he would not have been better than Obama, or that he would have made repeal and replace Obamacare more of a possibility, but because what a weak, weak, weak president he would have been at a time when we need a strong president the most. In this regard, he would have been no better than Obama. I'm not a big fan of continual campaigns. One right after the other, it seems like, in this country. But our campaign process does toughen up candidates. And if you can't take that, if that's too tough of a test, if you can't take that, then what will happen when you're president? Thirdly, who quits if they think they're sure that they could have won? Mitt Romney met with Jeb Bush last month, and I'll tell you exactly what they talked about. Romney asked Bush, "Are you really going to run?" And because Bush hasn't announced formally that he's going to run, he's just going through the process. And Bush said yes. And that was it. That was a tough, hard fight, too tough and too hard a fight for Romney, and he couldn't take it. Listen, folks, this is exactly what I'm talking about when I refer to the pussification of America. We have lost our ability, even our desire, to do battle, to wage war, and to wage war in order to win, with the whole purpose of winning. It is the most embarrassing. It's got to be almost embarrassing to listen to someone say, "I know I can win, but forget it because I might get a scratch." Absolutely embarrassing. Finally, Romney did the Elmos a favor. Instead of having to decide which candidate is more moderate than the other, the Elmos will have a choice between Jeb and Jeb, whom, as I have said, is just conservative enough to win the Elmo nomination, and Jeb is indeed quite conservative, and yet just moderate enough to win the general election. He does not and will not make social conservatism his central issue of the campaign, even though he has his own steadfast feelings about it. And he will listen to the right wing's ideas on immigration, but he will not waver from his own. And he has never been supportive of Obamacare, which Florida has no version of, unlike Mitt Romney. That reason alone was enough reason not to give Obama the nomination in 2012. Romney, but the Elmos have this amazing way of taking advice from the left, from the Smurfs, on who should be their, who would be their best candidate, who would most be able to help the Elmos grab that all-important independent swing voter. Why they always seem to listen to the left on this. They did it with both McCain and as well as Dole, as well as Romney. You always hear this right up to the election. You know, there's that McCain. He's a maverick. You know, he's the one. He's a, you know, if we didn't win, I could live with him as president. And as soon as he was the nominee, he's Mick Bush. He's the same as Bush. He's nothing but Bush. We'll just get more Bush, more Bush, more Bush. Do you want the same failed policies? That was the strategy then. And then they turned around and did it again with Mitt Romney. Same thing. There's a guy. Solid business person. I like the way he thinks. He would be a great person. If we lost, then we could live with a Republican like Mitt Romney. And then as soon as he was nominated, he was a bully. He was from Bain Capital, jobs killer. He bought companies just to rip them apart and tear apart lives in the process. It was unbelievable, uncanny how the Elmos constantly listened to the Smurfs on who they should run as a candidate. In fact, the only candidate that the Smurfs didn't advise the Elmos to run with was George W. Bush. And look, they won the White House twice. Imagine that. You know, they can say all they want about Bush, how bad he was or how stupid he was or how he couldn't talk and bumbled on his words and he always said nuclear instead of nuclear. But he beat your butt twice. Not by much. I'll grant you that much. Now, make no mistake, W was a moderate. From a fiscal point of view, he was a moderate Republican. And what have I always told you about moderate Republicans? They are the price is right of politics, as close to liberal as one can get without going over. Don't let the social nuttiness and the warmongering of George W. or the tax cutting fool you. W was just as spendaholic as any liberal, and tragically, that spendaholism has been used against the effectiveness of supply-side economics, because it wasn't supply-side, even though George W. Bush said it was. W was a moderate Republican. His brother is not. He was the governor of our state. I know this man is not a moderate Republican. He is conservative when conservatism matters, especially in the fiscal realm of things. Supply side is not just tax relief, folks. It's a spending restraint coupled with government restraint, meaning only the logical regulations, not over-regulation and triple regulation. So it is spending restraint coupled with government restraint coupled with tax relief in order to infuse the economy with much-needed capital for the sole purpose of expansion. Oh, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. First of all, yes, it does. Everywhere you employ it, even partially, it does indeed work. We have never really seen supply-side economics fully implemented, but where it was under J.F. Reagan and Bill Clinton, it absolutely, positively worked, and worked far better than Obama claims that his so-called middle-class economics is working. Did you hear that nice 4.6 growth that we had in the fourth quarter of the last fiscal year has fizzled to 2.4% for the first quarter of this year? Now, that would be the quarter that includes this past Christmas shopping season. Now, folks, that is not a good sign. Of course, we should have seen this coming. I did make a strong mention of the 0.9% drop in retail sales for December and 70-plus percent of our national GDP, as we've mentioned in Thursday's show, is consumer spending. So 0.9% is a big drop. In fact, it was the biggest drop in retail sales in over a year, and its announcement started the most recent slide in the stock market. So forget the rest of what Mr. Romney said, because it doesn't matter. He is a wishy-washy, flip-flopping, moderate Republican. A liberal, or even a moderate Republican, is not what we need in the White House. And the conservative, the truly fiscal conservative that we put in the White House, needs a supporting cast in Congress. That's what JFK had. Reagan worked with what he had, and Bill Clinton was forced into supply-side conservatism by the most conservative Congress America has seen in my lifetime. And that's the bottom line on Mitt Romney. He did us a favor by bowing out. I'm going to jump over to spending because I think that's really important. I'm not going to get a whole lot into the Koch brothers other than to mention that I read an article in Politico, which was apparently identifying that the Democrats are saying that the Koch brothers' goal of spending $889 million in the upcoming presidential campaign season, not just on president, but you know, on all other areas of government, has lit a flame under the Democrats. And I'm just going to tell you, man, they talked about retooling their message. That's the same old message. Harry Reid beat the Koch brothers over the head over and over and over again in the midterm elections, and they lost. I mean, you can't blame the people in Congress. They're not believing that it's Bush's fault anymore, 6 years into a presidency. So now you're going to beat up on, albeit they rich, American citizens and say it's all their fault that they're purchasing democracy. If they're going to go with that same, and I'm advising you, Smurfs, don't do it. You need to get away from that and actually do what you were talking about, retooling your message. Otherwise, you're going to kiss the White House goodbye. But I do want to get into the presidential spending because I think that's one of the most important cruxes of tonight's show. And I was reading this Politico article, which really got me thinking. Anyway, Obama, of course, you know, his whole speech, his purchase of the Union address, which we did a show on, was about buying the votes of the middle class. I mean, it was just one purchase after another. But President Barack Obama's 2016 budget proposal includes $74 billion in discretionary spending above the levels permitted by sequestration. That's what a White House official said this past Thursday. This increase amounts to a 7% increase over sequestration levels. The budget includes $530 billion in non-defense discretionary spending, which is an increase of $37 billion over the limits, that official said. Now, Obama's defense spending proposal totals $561 billion, which is a $38 billion more than the spending cap. So remember, the discretionary spending, that's not the mandatory spending, which includes primarily Social Security, Medicare, and welfare spending. You know, things that if somebody signs up for and they qualify, they pay, and America has to pay whatever the total tab is. There's no limits on that. It is what it is. We have almost no control over that without passing legislation. But on the when they talk about cuts, usually they're talking about discretionary spending. That includes non-defense discretionary spending, which is everything else. And then defense discretionary spending. That's pretty much how it's divided up. So that's how they're increasing. So on non-defense discretionary spending, and they're increasing that by $37 billion, and that's over the sequestration limits. And now that's very important for a point that's coming up in just a moment. But Obama's defense spending going up $38 billion over those spending caps. So what do the liberals do? Spend, spend, spend. Spend. This is their mentality, folks. It is the way they are programmed. But spending is only half of the liberal mentality. And this increase in $74 billion in spending, that's only half of Obama's increased spending plans. So listen up. The announcement provides the first details of how Obama will propose increasing spending when he releases his full budget proposal on Monday. He's going to make the case that the next round of automatic spending cuts should be canceled so that Congress can spend more. Did you hear that? Spend more. So Congress can spend more on national security and domestic needs, especially now that Congressional Budget Office has reported that short-term deficits are shrinking. Oh my gosh, are we going to talk about that? Those spending cuts are scheduled to begin in October. Now, so what Obama is doing here, he is suggesting that we spend $74 billion above those sequestration cuts. And now he's also suggesting that we cancel those sequestration cuts, which will increase spending even more. So that's key in this whole proposal. So $74 billion doesn't sound like a whole lot. It is a whole lot. But for a liberal, it's not a whole lot. Until you get rid of those sequestration cuts, suddenly it's a whole lot more. And I don't know exactly how much that tallies to, but man, if they were complaining about it last time, you know they would complain about it this time. So you propose spending above and beyond the spending cuts, and then you cancel the spending cuts. From a liberal standpoint, this is really quite brilliant. Republicans, of course, are rejecting that argument, saying that the nation's long-term spending pressures are still a problem, and Obama's proposals do nothing about them. They prefer to live within the lower spending limits. You mean live more within our means? And I use that phrase, more within our means, loosely, because the Elmos have been known to do some spending of their own. But isn't that why the deficit is coming down? Because we are spending less? That's not the only reason, folks. But the spending cuts were part of it. Remember, the other part of this is that employment, thanks to the true grit of the private sector, has been going up and up and up. And that's new taxpayers, and that is a primary source of revenue for this country. In addition, business investment is up thanks to the true grit of the private sector, and that's another source of revenues in capital gains. So very important to understand that that's why the deficit is coming down, not this so-called middle-class economics that Obama says he's doing when he, on the other side of his mouth, says Republicans aren't allowing them to do anything. So isn't that why the deficits are coming down? Because we're spending less. I have always said that spending is our problem, but liberals love to spend. And so the liberals' mentality is our problem. Think that the Elmos aren't, don't think for a second that the Elmos aren't infected with this half of the liberal mentality. Yes, just half. Spending is just half of the liberal mentality. We haven't even gotten to the other half of liberal mentality. Anyway, the Elmos would prefer to live within the lower spending limits and are likely to base their own budget proposals on the reduced levels of spending later this year. Will Allison, spokesperson for the House Budget Committee, he said it's disappointing, though not surprising, that President Obama is once again attempting to unravel a bipartisan fiscal accomplishment, which the sequestration was, in order to increase spending across the board and raise taxes. There it is. Did you hear it? It was just two words. So you might have missed it. So let me repeat them. Raise taxes. That is the other half of the liberal mentality. As Ronald Reagan said, there you go again. Tax and spend. And liberals are calling Reagan a moderate. So here is what they call a moderate calling out the liberal tax and spend mentality. Actually, it's tax so you can spend, but the price is the same. Will Allison goes on to say the president should work with the Congress to ensure that the military has the resources it needs to complete its mission and to achieve deficit reduction within the caps through smarter reforms and savings. Do you remember back in 2011, keep that in mind, smarter reforms and savings. Do you remember back in 2011 when sequestration, I think it was 2011, I could be wrong about that, but sequestration was considered to be so bad, so undesirable to both the Smurfs and the Elmos. The Elmos wouldn't want it because it was going to cut defense by half of the sequestration amount, and the other half was going to go to non-defense discretionary spending that the Smurfs wouldn't want to see cut. So it was supposed to be so bad that it would force both sides to come together and resolve their differences to avoid this disastrous fiscal cliff, is what they called it. Now, across which of the fiscal cliffs of A, across the board spending cuts, and B, the expiration of all Bush tax cuts. Then there was this weird deal where instead of all of the Bush tax cuts expiring, and instead of letting Obama raise taxes on the top 2% of the population, then the Elmos allowed Obama, this was their compromise, allowed him to raise taxes by 4% on just the top 0.5% of wage earners in the country. Oh yeah, and let us not forget that Obama let the middle class payroll tax holiday expire. Didn't even fight for it. So while all this was going on and everybody's going, yippee, we're taxing the top 0.5%, all of us lost a tax cut a tax break in our paychecks. Now, I'm not going to get too into how the upper 0.5% avoid this tax hike by simply reclassifying their income. Or that the expiring middle class would not be able to avoid the tax hike because it's stolen. Voluntarily surrendered right out of our paychecks. I just want you to see that nobody, not the Elmos, not the Smurfs, not even Obama, nobody fought to keep the middle class taxes from going up by extending the payroll tax holiday. Nobody. That what they settled for was 0.5% for Obama up at the upper crust of the income earners. That's what he settled for. Obama got his tax hike. That was the compromise and avoided certain disaster of tax hikes on everyone. Remember, even Obama agreed that eliminating all the Bush tax cuts would be disastrous for the economy. He fought against doing that when he first became president, letting the Bush tax cuts all. Anyway, he got his tax hike and avoided certain disaster of tax hikes on everyone. And the sequestration cuts were delayed for 3 months so that the president and the Elmos could negotiate what they all called smarter cuts. And not that the two sides would have ever agreed on what constituted smarter spending cuts, but that didn't really matter because Obama, true to form, moved the goalposts, he moved the goalpost by immediately demanding more of what he had already gotten, more of what he had already compromised on, tax cuts, and holding the smarter budget cuts hostage to more tax hikes. So what did we get when that whole thing came to head? We got across-the-board sequestration cuts. It was going to be horrible. It was going to be painful. It was going to send us into a double dip in the recession that we were so trying to avoid. Both sides were saying it, and both sides were saying that, while both sides were blaming each other for doing it. It was the Elmos' fault because they wouldn't agree to even more tax hikes that they had already given the president, and it was the president's fault for insisting that his compromise was, on second thought, not good enough for him or his liberal base. So sequestration cuts went into effect. The Elmos said that was the whole point. If we could not agree on smarter spending cuts, if we couldn't come to terms and find some way to control spending in a smarter way, in a more specific way, then sequestration was the next best thing to getting our spending habit under control. Meanwhile, the Smurfs were insisting that we raise taxes so that we could avoid sequestration cuts. That's it. Keep spending. So again, tax and spend. Tax so you can spend, and actually tax more so you can spend more. In the meantime, the Elmos were willing to take fully half of the sequestration cuts on their hallowed defense spending. This very issue was supposed to force them. Cuts in defense spending, cuts to the Pentagon were supposed to force them to negotiate for smarter spending cuts. in order to get spending more under control, they were willing to allow sequestration to hit the Defense Department. That, to me, was quite a stand for conviction. That spending is the problem here. They agreed to the 0.5% increase on the top 0.5%, the 4% increase on the top 0.5%. But spending cuts were still part of it. They waited 3 months. It was time, and the sequestration went into effect. And it isn't the first time that the Elmas had insisted on spending cuts. And correct me if I'm wrong, but with the very little in terms of tax hikes, our deficit is coming down, right? Do you see? So as employment goes up, we get more taxpayers. As business investment goes up, we get more capital gains as well as corporate tax from those businesses that the capital investment funds to create. And all the jobs that creates. So we're getting that, and at the same time we're cutting spending, and what are we getting? Reduced deficits. Stands to reason. I mean, they didn't even have to raise taxes that much in order to get there. So our shortage in revenue, as I've always said, is short-term. Due to the recession and the sluggish recovery, as we employ more people, we gain more revenue. We added nearly $30 billion annually to our revenue in 2014 in just the last 2 months of 2014 alone. And just the 500-plus thousand jobs, net jobs, that we created in November and December, that added $30 billion annually to our revenues in 2014 alone. That's just the net new jobs in those 2 months. It could have been better, and it will be better if our private sector keeps creating jobs. And they will, because that's what I believe in, the true grit of our private sector. It has always been the backbone of the United States of America. Now, Obama isn't really making his case, of course. They noted, the political article noted, he's not really making this case for spending more money now that our deficits are so-called under control to Republicans or to the Elmos. He's making it to his Democrats and their supporters. That is, he's not shooting for a solution here. He's just playing 2016 offense for his party that he promised them he would play. He's scheduled to outline his plan to House Democrats at their retreat in Philadelphia. That was last week. And he has already given a preview of his combative tone, so much for working together, right? Of his combative tone in an op-ed in the Huffington Post, I think it was Friday, suggesting that he's broadcasting mainly to a liberal audience. And that's right, that's the Huffington Post. I'm sure they were just salivating at the mouth for this presidential op-ed. They would love to be his launching pad for the battles of liberalism. But it indicates that Obama is not focused on the middle-class solutions here. So-called middle-class economics. He is simply igniting his liberal base against the new Elmo Congress to give them fodder for 2016. It's always about the next election. So in his op-ed, Obama Hood, I call him Obama Hood like Robin Hood, that's what he's trying to pretend to be, Obama Hood writes, "If Congress rejects my plan and refuses to undo these arbitrary cuts, it will threaten our economy and our military." Here he goes back. Remember, these were the scare tactics back when sequestration first happened. That's exactly what it was. Tell me these aren't the same old scare tactics that he's used before. He started out using them. He started out his presidency, remember, using them. "If you don't give me $787 billion of your taxpayer money, then we are going to fall into a depression, spiraling into the abyss." Those were the words he used. "Spiraling into the abyss that we may not be able to crawl out of." I'm paraphrasing that, of course. "Always to get more money to spend. This is the aim. Always. Investment is key in key areas will fall to their lowest level in 10 years, adjusted for inflation, putting American research ahead of infrastructure and national security at risk." More scary stuff. "But if Congress joins me," translation, "if Congress does it my way," do you see this man is so delusional? What he is saying here is that even though I lost in the midterms by an even bigger than I won re-election. Even though the people clipped my wings and voted against my policies, every one of which, make no mistake, was on the ballot this past November. Even though the people took on one, not just one chamber, they took both chambers of Congress away from me because they realized that taking only one chamber wasn't good enough. Even though the will of the people was overwhelmingly expressed, the Elmos, no, not just the Elmos, everyone should still do it my way. Anyway, but if Congress joins me, we can make sure that ending sequestration is fully paid for by cutting inefficient spending and closing TAPS loopholes. By cutting inefficient spending. Do you hear this crap? He's proposing $74 billion more in spending. More spending. More. This is how he defines spending cuts. By spending more. But spending more isn't good enough. Oh, no. We must also end the sequestration cuts, which amount to even more spending. More, not less, but more. Again, redefining spending cuts by spending more. And he wants to do it all by raising taxes because that's the two-pronged liberal regressive approach. Tax and spend. Tax so you can spend. Tax more so you can spend even more. It has always been thus, and it shall always be thus. And it led me to another article that I thought was just really fantastic, where Obama is doubling down on the middle class economics, also in Politico, which does the public care more about, cutting spending or middle class economics? That's how the article started out. Those are the battle lines for next year, and they are battle lines. In the budget he's releasing Monday, President Barack Obama is betting that Americans prefer middle-class economics to reducing federal deficits. Since short-term deficits are down, the logic goes, more Americans will be less worried about them and more interested in middle-class tax breaks and more spending on new benefits like free community college. That is... Now is our time to be tricking the masses into thinking that we are not buying their votes, but that they deserve this, that they have the right to all of this free stuff that they are entitled. He's also sure that Americans hate the automatic budget cuts known as sequester as much as he does, and will rally to his call to get rid of it, especially if they can have, and I love what Politico does here, I couldn't even believe it when I read it, if they can have the middle class goodies instead. They actually called them goodies. I was so stunned by that. So eliminate spending cuts and replace them with spending increases that purchase massive amounts of votes with, wait for it, goodies. What do I call them? Freebies, not free to taxpayers, but free to the recipients. Are we at such a deteriorated state as a country that we are all willing to trade our most precious American right, the right to vote, for mere trinkets? Is that what we're saying? Is that we can be bought? Here we are, so positively livid that our politicians' votes can be bought by special interests. But we, as a people, have we become no different? Our vote for sale to the highest bidder? Obama's $4 trillion budget would produce a $474 billion deficit for fiscal year 2016, rising to $639 billion in 2025. This is without a recession, folks, a recession which would surely come. They always do. They're cyclical. I'm not saying that what Obama's doing would cause it. These recessions happen for a combination of reasons, but they're cyclical. That what goes up must come down. He wants to tax foreign earnings. And I'm going to tell you, folks, this is something that I tend to agree with. I'm not really sure about the numbers here, but a one-time 14% tax on foreign earnings and a 19% tax on future corporate profits overseas to help pay for $478 billion in infrastructure repairs over 6 years. Now, I've done a show on this. We do need to fix our infrastructure. That goes without saying. That's something that needs to be done, and it's going to cost money. Here we've got a number, $478 billion over a six-year period. It's something that needs to be done. But I'll maintain, as I always have, that it's a cost. It's an investment, no doubt, but it's an absolute cost. They're going to fix roads. They're going to fix bridges that already exist. They already have people working there. Will they create temporary jobs? Yes, absolutely. Just like the XL pipeline will, but those temporary jobs are no good. Only the temporary jobs that have the stamp of approval of liberalism are good. We have to fix these things. That will create construction jobs. That goes without saying. But these things should be treated as a cost. They should be done timely, efficiently, and with as little cost to the taxpayers who are paying for them as possible. That's how infrastructure should be done. If it creates some permanent jobs, like if we do high-speed rail, we don't have that in a lot of places. If we do high-speed rail and it employs people, fantastic. Infrastructures, projects that create long-term jobs are things that we need that we don't have. I've always been a proponent of building more and more and more desalinization plants. We need them. We don't have them. That's the thing. That's what creates permanent jobs down the road. And temporary jobs while they're being built. Very, very important. I don't deny that that should happen. I've always said in the past, George Bush did a temporary, what they call the tax holiday, where if corporations would repatriate some money, whatever money they repatriated, they would only pay a reduced tax of 5% on. There you go. That was it was a great idea. Smurfs poo-pooed on that, saying it wouldn't even bring in much money. It brought in 10 times what the Smurfs said it would bring in, and it was a one-time thing. So they used it for whatever they wanted to use it for. If this was something that was constant, and then we earmarked it for infrastructure, there would be – why tax the money and let it stay out of the country? Require it to be repatriated to be taxed at a lower rate, and then earmark it for infrastructure. Anyway, an idea that I tend to agree with, but at the same time, it's part of this overall proposal of increasing spending on so many other things and reducing spending cuts that are already negotiated and set into place. The Republican Party institutionally has a problem with the middle class. This is from Pete Weiner, and they do. That is their stigma. And a lot of it they brought on themselves. They need to deal with it, said Pete Weiner. He's a senior fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center and a leader of the Reform Conservative Movement. I don't think that they should jettison their concerns for fiscal sanity. Not that they're always concerned about that, folks. Remember, Elmos have spending problems of their own. I just think that they've got to broaden their message, their bandwidth, a lot. White House officials are convinced that Obama will have the upper hand in this battle. You see, that is all any politician is looking for, the upper hand. It's not about the U.S. It's not about us. It's not about the middle class. If he didn't have the middle class, if he didn't have us to give goodies to, then Obama would just have to find another way. But this way is so damn easy. By most of the people's votes, by giving them someone else's money, they say the new budget will still address the long-term fiscal problems and even bring down the debt in later years of the budget, because the math will still work out between the spending and the new revenues Obama proposals would raise. I don't know how many times I got to point out, rich people have lawyers and accountants waiting in the wing to avoid whatever taxes you try and raise on them. It's not the tax revenues never match. It's all about growth in the economy. If you suck money out, it's not going to increase the economy, and it's not going to increase things the way they need to be increased. Anyway, Again, tax and spend. Tax so you can spend. Tax more so you can spend more. It's the more plan, not the middle class economics plan. That's the approach they say they've used in the past in Obama's past budgets, and that's what they'll do again this year. What? Obama budgets? There were 6 years with absolutely no budget. Please. A Pew Research Center poll in January found that 64% of Americans say that the budget deficit is the top national priority. That's down from 72% in 2013, which is where it peaked. And yet Obama did well when he outlined his middle-class proposals in his Purchase of the Union address. That's true. According to a CNN poll taken after the speech, 61% of the public thought his proposals to help the middle-class Americans would be somewhat effective. Just 37% thought they would be ineffective. That's 61% to start. It'll be interesting to see where that number goes from as people start to realize that they're simply being used in order to get the upper hand. They figured out in the midterms, and they'll figure it out again. Of course, the CNN poll happens to match, by the way, a Fox News poll, which was released from the State of the Union, that found that 61% of Americans prefer to improve the economy for everyone, while just 35% want to target the middle class. So a lot of this polling really depends on how a pollster actually phrases the question. Anyway, the White House officials insist Obama's budget isn't going to present the middle class economics and deficit concerns as an either-or battle. In fact, Obama is suggesting that he'll find ways to pay for the higher spending so that it doesn't just create more deficits. And here's the thing that he said again. We already quoted this from the HuffPo op-ed. If Congress joins me, we can make sure that ending sequestration is fully paid for by cutting inefficient spending and closing tax loopholes. Again, we're back to the I'm going to spend more, then I'm going to eliminate sequester cuts, and somehow I'm going to pay for it all by cutting inefficient spending like he's never done before and closing loopholes. Folks, if Obama is going to pay for all of this by closing loopholes, then he's going to have to close loopholes that impact the middle class. As Margaret Thatcher said, there are not enough rich people to cover Obama's ass. Well, she didn't quite put it that way, but you get the point. Still, Obama and his aides clearly have been shifting their spotlight to the middle class concerns, and they're happy to spike the football on declining short-term deficits, which are about to drop to their lowest level in 2007. This is and yet those deficits are still as high as the Bush deficits that Smurfs were bitching about right before the recession jumped the deficits up over $1 trillion, which is where Obama kept them through his whole first term. So do you want to know how to keep people from worrying about a $450 billion deficit? Run them up to over $1 trillion for 4 years straight. It's like doubling your price in your store so that you can have a 50% off sale. Think about it. Gas, for example, was nearly $4 a gallon, over $4 a gallon in some places. Now it's down around $2, and everyone's happy. But think back further to the time where gas first hit $2 a gallon for the first time. People were bitching about that like there was no tomorrow. It's all about perspective. Yay, the deficits are coming down. That's a good thing. But $450 billion is not the place to stop. It is ridiculous to think that the middle class is going to lack concern for nearly $500 trillion being added to our debt each and every year. Ridiculous. And if the people don't worry about that, then maybe Gruber was right. Now, here's the facts. The year things started to unravel in the banking and housing industry was in 2008. Our budget deficit then was $456 billion. This is numerically documented. This is the same deficit amount from which Obama intends to launch more spending. But he was all over Bush's ass and Mick Bush, against whom he was actually running. And here is what Obama said about $456 billion deficit, which, by the way, was the standard 2.5% of GDP. Anyway, here is what Obama had to say about such a deficit. Now, in 2008's presidential campaign, Obama echoed Krugman's deficit concerns. That deficit, you know, Krugman's now like deficit's no big deal. But back then, Krugman was on an anti-deficit campaign. Krugman's deficit concern was echoed by Obama. This is from a speech on July 3rd, 2008. The way Bush has done it over the last 8 years is to take out a credit card from the Bank of China in the name of our children, driving up our national debt from $5 trillion for the first 42 presidents and add $4 trillion all by it on its own, so that we can now have over $9 trillion of debt that we are going to have to pay back. That's irresponsible. That's unpatriotic. Irresponsible and unpatriotic. So is Obama calling his acceptance now that it's no big deal? Even though we will be no less a percent on GDP than Bush was. Only in 2009, when the deficit shot to $1.2 trillion, to which Obama added another $200 billion, did the deficit jump 10% to 10% of GDP. In fact, before things started to unravel in 2008, the Bush deficits were coming down. I don't know if with the actual dialogue that's out there, you wouldn't think that that was true. Nobody would even think about it. Do you know what the deficit was in 2007? Anyone? A mere $170 billion, down from its peak in 2004 of $412 billion when everyone was griping that Bush was increasing the deficit, which he was, no question about it. But that, Bush's deficit, those were irresponsible. That was pulling out your credit card from the Bank of China. That was unpatriotic. And then there are the facts. Now, including $1.2 trillion of 2009's fiscal year for Bush and only $200 billion for Obama, the total deficits under Bush for all 8 years, $3.2 trillion. $3.2 trillion. That averages out to $400 billion a year. Total deficits under Obama for 5 years, and I'm not counting 2009. I'm just adding the $200 billion that he added, and that's a conservative estimate. Total deficits under Obama for those 5 years, $5.222 trillion. That's $1.04 trillion a year. Mind you, this is for all 8 years of Bush, including most of the deficit for the recession, which ended in June of 2009. The only part of those numbers I'm giving to Obama is $200 billion from his stimulus plan, and that's being conservative because he did so much more spending in that fiscal year that ended September 30th of 2009, 3 months after the recession ended. So again, Bush averaged $400 billion a year, including that $1.2 trillion from 2009, while Obama has averaged over $1 trillion for the 5 years after the recession ended. And now he wants to brag that the deficit is so good that it's time to reverse course and start spending more. This coming year's deficit is still more than Bush's average, including the $1.2 trillion from 2009. Democrats say that the easing of the deficits gives Obama an opening to argue that there's no need to keep squeezing domestic spending. Bullshit. Man, folks, I mean, it just goes without saying. I don't know what else to say about this. You're going to increase spending when the deficits are still nearly $500 billion a year. And you're going to reduce spending cuts, thereby probably doubling your increase in spending, if not more. It's just, what did he say? It's just, we don't want to quote him right. Irresponsible. It's unpatriotic. It's taking out a credit card from the Bank of China, even though China really doesn't hold a lot of our debt, in the name of our children and driving up our national debt. Because if Bush raised it $5 trillion, or $4 trillion, let me backtrack that. If Bush raised it $4 trillion, Obama's done a much better job than Bush in matching those first 42 presidents. So it just something that really... I don't think the American people are going to buy it. I have more faith in them than Mr. Gruber does. I'm just going to leave that as it is. The anyway, turning to overseas, Barack Obama, of course, the latest ISIS beheading, he called it heinous and barbaric. He denounced it as barbaric. The Islamic, I call them the, I think ISIS stands for Islamic Scum of Syria and Iraq, because that's what these guys are. You know, it's like Charles Barkley said of the people that were rioting and looting in Ferguson. Those aren't black people. Those are scumbags. And that's exactly what I think here. These people aren't, they're just scum. But I don't know anyone who would call these people ISIL. And legitimize them. I don't know why anyone would do that. And legitimize them as a state or the Levant. But our president calls them ISIL, and so now most do. Most of the press. The article even spells it out: the Islamic State of the Levant. Bullshit. These are hardly a JV team, but they are simply a well-funded mafia, and that means and they mean business. If you don't pay up, then they're going to kill you, and they might kill you anyway. Anyways, the Islamic scum of Iraq and Syria beheaded another person this past weekend, the second Japanese citizen in less than a week. And here is what our president had to say. In a White House statement, the president condemned the video as heinous. Obama said in a statement that through his coverage of the conflict in the Middle East, GOTO, courageously sought to convey the plight of the Syrian people to the outside world. That's very nice, but what are you going to do about it? Last week, the Islamic scum of Iraq and Syria demanded $200 billion with 72 hours for both captives' safe release. When the Japanese rightly did not capitulate, they killed Haruna Yukawa, and then a couple of days ago, Kenji Goto. There is no way of knowing if the Islamic, if ISIS would have killed them anyway, but they would have likely released them to encourage others to pay up. I don't know. Are there any stories where ISIS has released a prisoner after a country paid up? I think there's some prisoner swap going on with that downed Jordanian pilot, but prisoner swaps are different. I hear this swap is dude for dude, too. One guy for one guy. Did you hear that? President Obama, did you hear that? Yeah, one dude for one dude. So the president also said that the U.S. would stand in solidarity with Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, I'm not really sure how you say that, and with Japan. Big whoop. So what are you going to do about it? Standing together with a broad coalition of allies and partners, the United States will continue taking decisive action to degrade and ultimately destroy ISIS. Gee, that's it. That's what you call what you're going to do. That's called what you're doing now. Bombing raids that aren't degrading or destroying, but at best stopping ISIS advances. And even that is debatable. How many more beheadings and executions does there have to be until we upgrade our policy from degrade and ultimately destroy to all-out attack and immediately destroy? They are a JV team. Come on. What in the hell are you waiting for? Now, not to be left out of the limelight, Secretary of State John Kerry released a statement saying, "We share the sorrow and continue to stand shoulder to shoulder with our ally Japan in confronting terrorism." Man, we are so lucky that this bonehead didn't become president ever. He is bad enough as Secretary of State. What are you going to do about it? In a statement, the outgoing Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said, "Goto's murder reminds the world of the threat that we confront in the Islamic State of Iraq and Levant." Even he calls it them. ISIS. That's right. They're a threat. Well, thank you, Captain Obvious, but what are we going to do about it? Interesting that you should ask that, Splash, because Chuck Hagel has more about that. Really? Do tell. Oh, man. This Chuck Hagel, these Secretary of Defenses that are leaving Obama, they're going to be the death of him. I mean, Hagel, this is a story out of Reuters. Outgoing Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel said in an interview on Friday that the United States might eventually need to send in non-combat troops. non-combat troops. I am so stuck on that word, eventually. Hang on 1 second, folks. I'm so stuck on that word, eventually. What in the hell are we waiting for? And then there's this whole notion of non-combat. I have two words for troops sent into a danger zone without a mission of offense. Sitting ducks. Obama is on offense here at home. Why not our troops? He's politically on offense. Why not our troops? If we're sending them over there, send them in enough numbers to get the job done. More about that in a moment, but back to the article for now. Hagel, who announced his resignation under pressure in November, told CNN that the options must be all options must be considered in Iraq. It's almost like Hagel, because he's on his way out, is saying that all options are not being considered. Anyway, all options must be considered, including sending troops for non-combat roles such as gathering intelligence and locating Islamic State targets. Will they be armed? What will they do if they're attacked? Why wait to be attacked? The more troops we send into the region, and we have 4,500 troops there already, the more likely they are to be attacked, especially if the number of troops remains so small. Wouldn't this be a feather in the cap for ISIS to attack our troops that are coming over there to support those that stand against them, if they're actually standing against them? I think it may require, this is Hagel again, it may require a forward deployment of some of our troops, he said. I would say we're not there yet. Whether we get there or not, I don't know. Listen to this man. It may require. We're not there yet. He doesn't know. You know what this sounds like to me? It sounds like Hagel knows what needs to be done. He fought tooth and nail behind closed doors to get it done with an administration that didn't want to do what needed to be done. And so Hagel was forced out, and now he's trying so hard to tell us, the protected, the ones being threatened, that not enough is being done without putting Obama in yet another bind of yet a third Secretary of Defense, saying that Obama simply is out of his league, that Obama does not know what he's doing, that he is still treating ISIS like a JV team he said they were. That's what it sounds like to me. Hagel's comments echoed testimony by General Martin Dempsey, chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff to Congress last fall, when he said U.S. troops might need to take a larger role on the ground in Iraq. Again, with the word might. What's with this maybe shit? What in the hell are we waiting for? This seems eerily similar to our delayed involvement into World War II. Did we not think back then that Hitler would stop at some point and be satisfied with his current conquest? Does Obama think that at some point ISIS is going to lay down their guns and say, okay, experiment in jihad is over, we are satisfied with what we have? These guys mean business. They are not going to stop, and somehow or another, they keep getting funded. Such deployments would be in addition to the measly 4,500 U.S. troops already committed to training and advising roles in Iraq. Folks, these are boots on the ground. You know, the ones Obama swore to remove from Iraq rather than send in. Yeah, those. Now, make no mistake, I am all for boots on the ground here. Combat boots. The ISIS and understand nothing but fear and force. There is no reasoning with them here. They are not enough. There are not enough moderates in the Middle East with enough kahunas to get this job done. We are the only ones. Europe won't do it without us. We must lead. We must unite them. And if Obama would just unite them, unite our allies, they would follow him. And so would I. But we cannot send in a meaningless few thousand troops with no combat mission and say we are merely attempting to degrade ISIS and ultimately destroy them. We have to send in an overwhelming force intended to crush them and immediately destroy them before they behead another person. Immediately, not ultimately, immediately. We need to show these bozos what jihad really is. Strike fear into their hearts. Turn their own concept of terror inward on their own selves. That's what we need to do. And if we don't do it, if we rely on might, maybe, and eventually, then ISIS is going to get bigger and bigger, nastier and nastier, and more of a threat. There will be more and more kidnappings, ransom demands, and gruesome beheadings. If America does not act, eventually the people in the region stolen by ISIS will eventually surrender to their newfound fate of the terrorized people. Ultimately, they will fight for ISIS instead of practically practicing mere apathy. It is time to act. Actually, it was time to act. But just as in World War II, against a power infinitely more dangerous than ISIS, it is not too late to act. But we must act in large scale and decisively. If we don't, then we're going to regret it, as the world loses even more confidence in America than it has already lost. Well, that's a wrap for tonight's show, folks. Join us tomorrow night, where we have no idea what we're going to talk about, but we'll decide overnight and put it into the blog tomorrow. Check us out at 1111broadcasting.com. We'll be here again tomorrow night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And until then, do what you love and love what you do.